Алексей Навальный на втором месте. Он может победить Сергей Собянин с результатом около 6.
Кандидатом Ройзмана еще нет.
Выборы пройдут в один тур.
Мы выбираем наш путь.
Этот город самый лучший.
There's something about autumn in Russia. As the weather cools, the political environment tends to heat up. There was that tumultuous fall of 1991 that ultimately led to the breakup of the Soviet Union. There was President Boris Yeltsin's shelling of parliament in October 1993, which, in essence, created the super-presidency that dominates Russia to this day. And there was that fateful autumn of 1999, which saw renewed conflict in the North Caucasus, mysterious apartment bombings in Moscow, and the rise to power of an obscure ex-KGB colonel named Vladimir Putin. And it was in the autumn of 2003 when Yukos CEO Mikhail Khodorkovsky was arrested and Putin locked down his total dominance of the political system. And as we enter September 2013, the coming autumn is shaping up to be another one of those highly consequential political seasons. It, of course, kicks off this weekend with regional elections across the country in which 8 Russian regions will elect governors, 16 will elect legislatures, 8 cities will elect mayors, and 5 will elect city councils. From Alexei Navalny's outside-the-box insurgency in Moscow to Yevgeny Roizman's strong bid for the top job in Yekaterinburg, September 8th should prove to be a seminal day for Russia. But while what happens on Sunday will no doubt be important and interesting, the real action will come in the days, weeks, and months that follow. Hello, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RVRL. I'm all alone in the studio in Prague, and I'm still nursing my ailing back that has kept me out of action all week. And Mick Jagger was right. It is a drag getting old. Joining me on the Skype line, though, is somebody who is aging much more gracefully than I am. Co-host Mark Galeotti is a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Great to be back.
It was greater to have you in the studio, but it's great to have you on the Skype line. Mark, at the outset, I listed a few highly consequential autumns in the past, 91, 93, 99, 2003. There was 2004 when Putin abolished the election of governors. Does 2013 have the makings of one of those watershed seasons?
In a way, I think it does. I mean, if we look at those previous watersheds, and it's interesting how precisely when everyone comes back from the dacha, that's when things sort of hot up politically. Each of those cases was representing a challenge to the state. And in therefore, I think the big variable was how the state could and did respond, whether it's basically in collapsing away as it did with the August coup, or whether it's conversely redoubling its efforts to consolidate its grip on society, for example, with a Khodorkovsky arrest. So really, I think what this tends to mean is that we get situations in which opposition forces of one form or another, whether we're talking about oligarchs or hardliners or radicals, see a potential window of opportunity and they push on that window. But then the key issue is, okay, you know, what's the state going to do as a result? And I think what we're seeing here, which is interesting, is that the state, at least certainly as manifest in Moscow, and obviously we'll be talking a little bit about what might happen elsewhere, but in Moscow, the state has actually backed away from its previous hyper-maximalist approach. It clearly seems to have had a change of heart over Navalny. They rigged this ludicrous embezzlement charge. But then they decided to allow him to stand for Moscow mayor. And it looks as if that was definitely a shift in strategy rather than part of some long drawn-out plan. So they basically decided they're going to try and play the game. Try and win it on an essentially, basically, generally, in the main, fair election, which, you know, clearly Sobyanin's going to win. That's not in question. And, frankly, would win fairly, just as, you know, to be honest, Putin did the presidential elections. You know, if they hadn't rigged it at all, he would have still won. And hope that in that way they can sort of take the fangs out of the opposition movement. So it's an interesting and more subtle response. But I think what it shows is that we have a state that is still able and willing to retain power. And I think the point is then that if it doesn't work, if sort of on day one of the post-election order, the opposition doesn't crumple or say, oh, well, that was worth a try. You know, if Navalny's proposed protests take place and so forth, then the question will be, okay, well, what's the state going to do then? Is it going to have the confidence to keep a low profile, or will it return back to maximalism? And my view is actually that the latter is likely. I don't think that we're going to see the state willing to think of it in terms of a sort of a 12-month or whatever program of pacifying the opposition. I think they'll actually be more likely to resort back to the vicious methods we saw earlier in the year.
But what about Navalny has, as we pointed in the past, become the central figure in this. It's no longer about the opposition. It's about Navalny and his network in so many ways. And yes, Sobyanin is going to win in a technical sense. He's going to be elected mayor of Moscow. But winning and losing here are relative things in a lot of ways. First of all, could Navalny push this to a second round? And because some people in the know are saying this could happen. Could Navalny push this to a second round? And if so, what are the implications of that?
Well, here we get to the point of, how far is the state willing to play the legitimate game? Mm. I'll be honest, and it's incredibly dangerous and foolhardy to say these things just on the evening of an election, but never mind. I don't think it's going to get to a second round. Firstly, because Sobyanin does seem to have a fairly sort of solid basis for support. But secondly, if there was one thing that I think the Kremlin political technologists will want to avoid, it's that.
Yeah.
And therefore, if the genuine result is in the sort of, 47-48% for Sobyanin, that's the point where I feel they will feel too great a temptation just to put their fingers on the scales and just to bring him over that sort of,
But if they put the fingers on the scales, which is what they did in the Duma elections in 2011, quite frankly, they put their fingers on the scales and they got caught with their fingers on the scales, so to speak. And there's every reason to think if they put their fingers on the scales this time, they're going to get caught out again. Mm-hmm. And people are, Navalny getting 25% is not out of the question right now. It's far from out of the question. I mean, I'm paying less attention to what the polls are saying into what kind of analysts with inside knowledge who have a good idea of how the real vote's going to go are talking. And the 25% seems to be a good ballpark figure right now, which is far beyond what we expected Navalny would be able to get when this whole show started. So if they put their fingers on the scales, aren't they playing with fire there? Aren't they creating another December 2011 moment?
Yeah, and this is why I would say it's very much the case that it's actually the state that will decide what kind of complexion this political season has. I absolutely agree that however clever they think they are, if they try to rig the election, even if it's just by a percentage point or two, they will get caught. I think that so much of the effort of the Navalny campaign has been precisely to ensuring that you have a wide network of observers, both overt and covert, exactly to spot that. And, if there's one thing that he and his team are very good at, it's spotting those kind of shenanigans.
One of the many things they're good at.
Yeah, exactly. And Navalny has already put in this preemptive bid to hold a protest meeting on Lubyanka Square the day after the election. So he's already basically trying to build himself a platform in case he wants to then sort of once again use the we've been robbed campaign. So I think this is it. I mean, if Navalny gets 25%, that is actually a very very strong showing.
That's a victory. That's a victory.
Yeah, on the principle that you can have multiple victories. I certainly wouldn't want to rule out Sobyanin's going to win a victory, which actually is going to be very important for politics within the elite and Sobyanin's position within it. But exactly, it's this point. It's actually, if they feel that temptation, if they think that they have an easy win, something that'll make life easier, the elite think, the Kremlin thinks, we can just rule out a second run. Because let's face it, if Navalny does manage to push this to a second stage, again, that is a major victory for him. he's still going to lose, in my opinion. In terms of winning the mayoral election. But again, we've spoken about this in the past. In many ways, one of the most debilitating things for his campaign would be to win, because then he'd become, you know, in charge of traffic jams and whatever else. But anything that gives him that all-powerful momentum is going to be really strong. And in that respect, look, if Sabianin naturally wins a 58%, then you know that's fine from the elite's point of view. The point is, though, that either if they rig the election to give him that first round victory, or if Navalny manages to push them to the to a second round, both of those are pretty disastrous for the Kremlin. Not because this regime is going to fall tomorrow, but again, it once again gives this spike of adrenaline to get the protest movement once again regalvanized, once again moving to the next stage. Because everybody who votes for Navalny will then feel as if we've been robbed.
Well, isn't this almost like the first round of a battle for the big chair, too? Because one of the things Sabianin is trying to establish here is that he is top dog among the potential successors. And if he can win a free and fair election against Alexei Navalny, who, let's face it, is the best the opposition has to offer as a candidate right now, then that positions him very strongly to be the anointed successor of the ruling elite, of Putin, among the ruling elite. It gives him a lot of cash there. And Navalny, if he gets his 25% or even 20, he's immediately a national politician. He's immediately the top dog among the opposition. And it's almost like he could form a shadow government, if you know, virtually almost. So is this kind of like round one of the fight for the big chair, maybe?
Yeah, I, whether or not either of the contenders will ever end up sitting upon it is a separate issue. But yeah, I mean, as is with Navalny, you know, it's fascinating if you look at, you know, even with all the limitations of the opinion polls, but you know, if we look at the sort of broad consensus, you know, the extent to which Navalny has squeezed out all the other opposition candidates is really quite striking. Yeah. And perhaps for me, the most dramatic one of all, you know, it's not that the LDPR is scoring low. Well, you know, big deal.
Right.
But it's actually looking at Ivan Melnikov, the Communist Party candidate, who is running third. He's a low-key candidate, but he's a serious one and so forth. Yeah. He's got the support of people like Belkovsky. But most importantly, the point is, he has the Communist Party machine.
Yeah.
And even with the only non-Kremlin-controlled political machine, you know, he's still about getting, if he's lucky, about around a third of what Navalny is currently polling, half to a third. And I think that what that says is precisely the extent to which Navalny is becoming this gravitational point toward which everybody who has a grudge against the current status quo, doesn't matter if they're aging communists, which, let's face it, you know, is pretty much an oxymoron, or whether it's just some young, you know, Muscovite hipster with an iPhone or whatever, it doesn't matter. The point is, exactly everything that makes Navalny more of the representation of, if you want change, vote for me, is exceedingly powerful to him.
Well, this is, and you said the magic word machine there. The communists do have the only machine that's not controlled by the Kremlin. But Navalny has something else we've talked about in this podcast numerous times in the past, and that's something a little more postmodern than a machine. He's got a network. He's got this network, and this election's a dry run of that network, and so far, it's been pretty damn impressive. I mean, he has changed the game. If you really think about it, you have this candidate in here who the Kremlin did everything to destroy, and he's still managing to pull what he's polling, to pull in the kind of support, to have the to bring the kind of people out to the rallies he's doing. He has changed the game. Win or lose, he has shown that you could run for what is, in essence, the second most important job in Russia, the mayor of Moscow, with not just no support from the authorities, but with staunch opposition from the authorities, and still come in second with 20 to 25%, if that's what he ends up getting. Has Navalny changed the game, win or lose, by showing everybody what is possible?
Well, you know my role in this. It's to take your enthusiasm and say, yes, but.
Somebody did this on Twitter. Somebody said they love my enthusiasm and they love how you guys always rein me. And I guess these are the roles we've... So, yeah, okay, go at it, since Kirill's not here.
Broadly speaking, I agree, but I'd have two caveats. First of all, you say the Kremlin's thrown everything against him. Well, it hasn't. I mean, I think this is one of the interesting things. You know, even if we go back to Lenin, you know, his view is that for a revolution to succeed, one of the absolute requirements is a critical absence of will on the part of the elite to actually hold on to power. And I think it's quite interesting the way the Kremlin flip-flopped and so forth. You know, they could have been a lot more vicious. Mm. They really could have, you know, finally taken the, you know, taken the full muzzle and leash off Bastrykin or whatever. They didn't. I mean, they certainly, you know, went against it. Yeah. but I think we have to accept the limitation there. But the second thing is, yes, there is this whole sort of the network versus the machine interesting paradigm. I still feel, though, that for the moment, that actually is Navalny's biggest weakness as a, you know, a politician able to really take the Kremlin on. I mean, a lot has been made about his, you know, a Western-style campaign that Navalny has waged. And in a way, he has. But it's much more, I would suggest, an idealized outsider's notion of a Western campaign. You know, it's all the glitz and the social media and the cool slogans or whatever. But if we look about Western politics, underlying all that usually is a large, ruthless, well-funded political machine that goes and does a lot of the sort of the boring nuts and bolts stuff. And the key thing about that is it's often the machine that allows you to do two things. One is to go beyond your obvious target audience. But secondly, to actually make sure that your target audience is whipped in the good sense of the word. In other words, you know, is there voting at the right time and the way you want it. Navalny very much relies on the kind of the adrenaline of enthusiasm. And that's great for short spurts. Given that I don't believe the Kremlin sort of power structure is going to fall any day now. You know, it is declining, it is decaying, but, you know, we're talking about a process that's going to take months and years. Adrenaline alone does not carry you through that, you know, through that kind of a marathon. And therefore, I mean, I think, so Navalny is changing the game to an extent, but I think Navalny also has to change if he really wants to win and understand that actually there's a point at which you can't just rewrite the rules, a point at which you have to play by the rules.
Well, Mark, you're taking it exactly where I want to take it. It's almost as if we scripted this.
Heaven forfend.
But, I mean, this to me leads to what is going to be one of the most important questions after Sunday, on September 9th and 10th and so on. Navalny's going to do well Sunday, I expect. Maybe I'm wrong. Won't be the first time, won't be the last, but I expect Navalny to do well on Sunday. I don't expect him to win. And I agree with you. I don't think he's going to be able to take to a second round, although, God, I think that would make things so interesting. But I expect him to do very well. And after that, the question is, do they try to co-opt him? And there's been lots of chatter in the press about this very thing. There's this conversation that Volodin supposedly had with some political strategists in the Kremlin about this, that maybe Navalny will be offered the role of being the top dog tolerated opposition leader with his own little political empire, and he becomes part of the game. I don't know if that's really that would be a smart strategy from the Kremlin's perspective, but my question is, would Navalny take that, number one? And number two, would he be wise to take that and still maintain the goals that he has right now, which is ultimately to be sitting in the big chair himself? So what would you say to that? Do you think he'll be made that offer? Do you think he'll take it? Do you think it would be wise?
I wouldn't be surprised if he has made that offer. I would be very, very surprised if he took it. Mm-hmm. And again, I think it reflects the essential clumsiness of the Kremlin strategy. The time to have made such an offer was a while back, you know, when positions hadn't become quite so firm. And in a way, and the point at which Navalny wasn't sort of riding high. You know, you do not buy stock when it's riding high. Mm-hmm. So I think that he probably is very well aware of the extent to which it will compromise him, anything like that. However, let me just throw in one other sort of potential variable. I mean, we very much have been positing this as the opposition cohered around Navalny versus the shadowy Kremlin deep state. We're increasingly seeing splits within the elite. And particularly going back to the point you made earlier about Sobyanin's kind of political aspirations and the extent to which they'll be furthered by his victory in this election. I mean, in many ways, we've got sort of, I would suggest, three broad wings within the elite. There's the straight down the line, Silovik, hard line, you know, keep, if necessary, Putinism without Putin, mm-hmm. of whom someone like Ivanov mm-hmm. is the obvious vampiric sort of successor.
Right. Vampiric successor. I like that.
Then on a slightly more sort of comic opera level, you know, we have someone like Rogozin, who would take it more of a sort of populist nationalist direction.
So we have vampires, comic opera. I'm dying to hear your third metaphor.
Yeah,
I like where you're going. I like where you're going.
The remainder, unfortunately, are much less exciting. You know, you have people like Shoigu and people probably like Sobyanin, mm-hmm. who are much more sort of pragmatic, technocratic. They don't, you know, they don't have an ideological base beyond just generally they want a strong, effective Russia. And these are precisely the kind of people who could deal not just with the Kudrins of this world, but also potentially some way down the line with the Navalnys.
Exactly. When Alexei meets Alexei and then they meet, you know, Sergei and Sergei. I mean, you know,
exactly. You know, this is
I love the symmetry.
Well, this is it. In a time of potential economic crisis, you have to cut down on four names. Now, in that situation, the thing about it, it's not purely a question of whether or not Navalny gets co-opted by the elite, but also in part whether Navalny can begin to co-opt elements
exactly,
of the elite.
Exactly. And that's where I think this might be going. Mm. When Alexei meets Alexei and the Alexeis meet the Sergeis, you know, so to speak, because I think you did, the way you just drew it out, I that's exactly how I would have drawn it out. And that is exactly the faction that Navalny could work with. We know he's already been working with Kudrin and his people. Mm. So Alexei has already met Alexei. The problem is the elite Alexei isn't really in the in those holding the levers of power part of the elite anymore. But that's where I think it might be headed, and a lot of this is not going to be visible in the days after. We're going to see the street posturing. And we're going to, you know, people are going to be laying down markers starting on September 9th or on the night of the 8th. But there's going to be some very, very high stakes negotiating going on behind the scenes. And what this all may, and here we go again. We are how many minutes into the podcast and we have not mentioned Putin's name yet. Where does this all leave Putin? I mean, is he even the great arbiter and the great decider anymore? Or is this, again, going back to a theme we have come back to endless times in here, is he becoming irrelevant in all this? Because, again, we haven't mentioned the man's name, except in my intro to talk about things he did 10 years ago, in this entire podcast yet.
Yeah, I can't help feeling that in some ways, you know, he has become like the Tsar, in the sense of, you know, he lives in a bubble of nicely frogged uniforms and sort of humble servitors. He has the joy of being able to posture on the global stage, you know, off at G20 and such like. I get the sense that he either has withdrawn himself from a lot of these kind of domestic political issues, or else actually is just simply not being consulted. That it's a case of, you know, you need not worry about that. We've got it in hand. You have global affairs to deal with. And as we know, you know, international politics are often a great distractor for rulers who have trouble asserting their power at home. So, I mean, in that respect, I think that, I mean, it's difficult because obviously, you know, he still has massive formal power. And, you know, if he wants to sack anyone, he can sack anyone and so forth. But real power, political authority, has to be constantly demonstrated to be maintained. You know, it's not just something that remains static sitting on a shelf. And therefore, I think there is a growing degree of irrelevance. It's an irrelevance that, as I said, he could turn around very quickly. You know, the Tsar is still the Tsar. But I certainly don't see him as being part of these processes. I mean, he clearly sort of, you know, has provided his sanction to the current strategy of dealing with Navalny. And I would be surprised if Volodin was publicly making these sort of comments about Navalny's, you know, having a potential role in the future without it having at least been run past him. Mm-hmm. But again, I see his role as being essentially quite passive at the moment. He's allowing the Volodins and the Vastrikins and so forth to really run domestic policy rather than actually him being the person who makes the decisions.
But isn't this a sea change? I mean, Putin's role has always been the decider, the indispensable man, the arbiter among the clans. And if he's out of the game now, and we're looking at this, and we just analyze, you know, the post-September 8th scenarios, does Navalny get co-opted? Does Navalny co-opt the technocratic part of the elite himself? And the name Putin didn't come up. It wasn't like, well, Putin might do this because this would be to his advantage to balance this clan against that. That's how we would have been analyzing this a year ago. And neither of us even went there. Mm-hmm. What does that tell you? This is a sea change, if I'm not mistaken. Pull me back. I'm getting too optimistic on us here.
No, actually, let me buck the trend and agree with you. I mean, this is the interesting thing. I would say that, frankly, from the point where he was sworn in again as president, we have actually seen a very different Putin. We have seen a Putin who is uncertain, and that's the one thing that he doesn't like to be. I mean, one of the reasons why Putin's role as the great decider has been so central to his government is precisely that, you know, that degree of almost insecurity he's had about letting other people have power, letting other people have autonomy. So he's tended to kind of let them run for a while and then rein them back and elevated a sort of a rival or whatever. But so the point is, I think now he seems, and again, you know, this is all speculation, but I have no problem with that. He seems terribly uncertain. Again, one of the things we had known about Putin for a long time is that he's not a gambler. He likes to make sure that he really has, you know, all his ducks in a row before going out and shooting them. but nonetheless, at this point, he really seems to have no sense of quite how things are going to play out. And his natural response seems to be to withdraw, to allow other people to do their thing. And, you know, I mean, again, I have no idea of knowing, but I would be very surprised if these days people even take issues to Putin that much. And again, if we look at the earlier Putin presidencies, there was this court-style scrabble in which people would constantly want to be seen with Putin. They would clearly take their issues to Putin precisely because they wanted the great decider to decide. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not just that we're not talking about Putin. It's that even if you look at, you know, the press that best reflects the views of the elite, accounts of discussion, our accounts of how policies are decided. You know, it's one thing, you know, even if you look at the floods in the Far East, you know, which is clearly a sort of, you know, a major national disaster. And yes, we've had the classic case of, you know, Putin flying in, making a sort of a high profile sacking.
Hero. Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. Appointing some new martial artist. There always seem to be martial artists these days into a sort of a key position. And, you know, there you go. The Tsar has come. All will be well. That's fine. I mean, you know, for a high profile thing like that, you know, there could not have been anything but a Putin intervention. But generally speaking, you know, even the elite aren't clamoring around to have him fix their problems. They're sorting it out themselves, amongst themselves. And I think that says, frankly, more than anything else about the decay of Putin's position.
No, he's gone from being the indispensable man to being the invisible man. I mean, this to me is, other than the rise of Navalny, this is the other side of the coin of the rise of Navalny. Is the amazing disappearing Putin, because he just, unless we're missing something, and we could be missing something, he's just not a factor right now. You spelled it out perfectly. We got the Putinism without Putin faction, whether it's the vampiric Ivanov or the comic opera Rogozin, they're basically the same ideology there. Mm-hmm. You have the kind of the technocrats with the, you know, your Shoigus and Sobyanins, and then you have Navalny. This is really what you have right now. And the Putinism without Putin folks, either vampiric or comic opera, they didn't want Navalny in this election. They wanted Navalny locked up. Mm-hmm. And they didn't get that. Now they want Navalny crushed in this election, but I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, the result is going to tell us a lot about who's winning as well. But at the end of the day, where this does seem to be going is some kind of entente between the Shoigu Sobyanin technocratic factor and Navalny and his people. I think that might be where this is. And that is what Volodin's comments about Navalny having a role in the system may seem to reflect. No, and in this sense, this could be one of those autumns of change.
Yeah. And in that respect, I mean, almost there is the potential prospect of, shall we say, a bidding war or a sort of a courtship. Because, you know, from Volodin's point of view, he's clearly thinking of Navalny on a national stage. That Navalny becomes the tame oppositionist, which is, as I said, I think would thoroughly emasculate Navalny. And, you know,
If he plays that role, or if he uses that role to play his own game. I mean,
it becomes difficult. I mean, to simply say, oh, well, I went along with this deal, but I think it would be a very, very difficult one to play. And I think, you know, one thing we have seen about Navalny is he's very, very good at this kind of new politics or whatever. We haven't really seen him being good at, as it were, old-style politics, or indeed just kind of factional stuff. However, I could also see a potential, and I mean, certainly if I were advising Sobyanin, I would say, you know, the moment that you win the election, you say, but that said, I was tremendously impressed by Navalny. Mm-hmm. I realize he has, you know, other sort of, you know, wider national level political concerns. Yeah, you know, but I think this is a man who could do real good for Moscow, and I would like to bring Navalny in as, you know, chief advisor on something. You know, an attempt on the one hand that looks like a degree of co-optation, but not something that would actually make Navalny feel that he was sort of being presented as a position of, you know, if you want to come into the tent, you're going to have to humble yourself. But also almost something that gives them an excuse to talk and for future, you know, almost allows them to begin to negotiate without it looking like negotiation. Mm. And it also begins to paint Sobyanin precisely as that bridge figure, mm-hmm. that the reasonable member of the elite who can actually broker. And if, you know, again, I mean, let's look at some of the parallels in Central Europe. You know, where we saw figures emerging within the old Soviet bloc communist parties, mm-hmm. who were trying to actually build themselves a future.
Kwasniewski and Mikhnik, for example.
Exactly. You know, I mean, whether or not it would work is a, you know, totally separate matter. You know, but nonetheless, you know, I think it will be for me, one of the interesting things will precisely be about, you know, whether Sobyanin later starts to try and present himself as being bigger than just the pro-Kremlin candidate.
Right. No, we're certainly in for an autumn of excitement. I'm not sure if we're in for an autumn of change. And you mentioned Bilkovsky, and he said that this mayoral election, in an article about a month or so back, he said this is the quarterfinal match in the Armageddon battle of good versus evil. The semifinal match is going to be the Duma elections, and the finals is going to be the presidential elections. And that's where Navalny's game is. But you almost feel that that's where Sobyanin's game is, you know? Mm. So now one thing I do have to remind myself as I look at the clock is there's more elections than just the one in Moscow. And the most interesting of the other one, of course, is going on in Yekaterinburg. I know you blogged about this past week, where Yevgeny Roizman, the anti-drug campaigner, is conducting a very, very vigorous campaign, for mayor there. How would you contrast how the authorities are dealing with Roizman, who's close to Prokhorov, by the way, and this is about the only remnant of Prokhorov's political network that we see visible right now. How would you contrast how the authorities are dealing with Roizman to how they're dealing with Navalny?
Well, it's precisely because Moscow is not just a city. Moscow is in many ways, you know, Russia. And therefore, what's happening in Moscow is clearly very much at the sort of not just the focus of the international press corps, but also Kremlin attention. Whereas Yekaterinburg, it's important, but it's by no means sort of as important. And I think there it's interesting because we're seeing a much more bare-knuckled campaign against Roizman, who is in some ways, I mean, I think closer to a sort of a Yeltsin-type figure in the sense of his sort of, you know, populist leanings and everything else. You know, this is a man who has all kinds of allegations about, you know, criminal activities in the past. He had a 2-year sentence at one point. He's been linked with the Uralmash crime group, though, you know, nothing clearly has been proven. And here we have the use of the police and the prosecuting authorities, you know, fairly nakedly against him. I mean, this most recent case where a couple of cops went on a local TV show, handily played bits of wiretapped conversation between gangsters in which they more or less said that they were close to Roizman and they'd do very well if he won the election. And only then was there talk of actually an investigation being opened. You know, it's clearly that they're trying to publicly smear him. Now, either we have a central Kremlin-planned campaign that is sophisticated and multimodal, or conversely, just simply decides that Roizman's a softer target, which I suppose is possible. But to me, what we're actually seeing is in Yekaterinburg, a local elite terrified of what this anti-drugs, anti-corruption, anti-current regime, basically, figure would do to their cozy understandings and deals if he actually became mayor. Because let's face it, you know, the mayor's role, on one level, you have very little power because, in most cases, you don't really have direct budgets that you raise.
In Moscow, you do, but yeah, in other
in Moscow, exactly. But you know, as in everything else, Moscow is different. But on the other hand, actually, the position of mayor can be terribly powerful as a spoiler. You can sack people. You can start investigations. You can do a lot of damage to the local elite, and he definitely is an outsider. So for me, what we're actually seeing in Yekaterinburg is, again, precisely another sort of portent of the apocalypse, as a local elite begins to think, well, how do we protect our own interests, regardless of thinking about what's going on in Moscow? And they use local prosecution, local police structures and so forth to destroy their enemies or attempt to destroy their enemies. And again, they're not thinking about Moscow. Mm-hmm. They're just thinking about, well, you know, what must we do? It's really quite striking the extent to which, you know, I think if you look at Yekaterinburg, and it's a very interesting campaign, it'd be fascinating to see what the results are going to be. But to me, what
I don't exclude that he can win.
No, exactly. Because the one thing that the elite don't have is the ability to smoothly rig the results. If they're going to rig the results, they're going to have to do so really clumsily. Mm. And I think that will be dangerous. And that would be the sort of thing that also could well arouse Moscow's ire. Mm. So, you know, Roizman might well win. Whatever happens, the point is no one thinks Moscow counts, mm-hmm. really, in this. And therefore, we're already seeing the fragmentation of the power vertical.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And there's another irony in all of this that just came to mind, and that is that I was always wondering why they made sure Prokhorov didn't get in the game in Moscow. And not just in Moscow, they prevented him from registering his candidates elsewhere. Yaroslavl is the most notable case. And what the press seemed to be saying about this is that the authorities were more afraid of Prokhorov than they were of Navalny, because Prokhorov could portend a split in the elite, where Navalny was seen as a radical opposition candidate outside the current structures, and that wasn't going to split the elite. What we've seen happen now is just the opposite, right? What we've seen now is we've just spelled out this potential Navalny has to split the elite, where Prokhorov, let's face it, he's the ultimate political entrepreneur, and they could play ball with him no matter what. So I think they really did not back the wrong horse, but exclude the wrong horse this time and created a potentially impossible situation for themselves. Before we move on, one thing I wanted to just to throw out there is, what do you expect on the day after? When we move past September, it's only a few days away. We're sitting here, it's Friday as we're recording. In 2 days, we won't be seeing results yet at this time, but we have a good idea where the election's. A little more than 2 days, we're going to know how this thing went. What do you expect the day after? Do we expect another December 4th, 2011 scenario, or do we expect something different this time?
Well, let's presume. I mean, I'm going to presume that there isn't going to be a second round, that Sobyanin squeaks through, and it's not on the basis of really obvious vote rigging. Three big assumptions, but nonetheless, let's work with those.
Three fair assumptions.
But I think it's still at that point, Navalny has to.
And what does Navalny get? 25, 20?
Yeah, I mean, 25 to 20. I mean, It's very difficult. I mean, if he gets 25, it's a triumph. If he gets more than 20, he's done well. If he gets less than 20, frankly, it's...
How you spin it. Yes.
Well, but for me personally, if he gets less than 20, I think that's actually a fairly, you know, not a good result. Mm. It shows he hasn't got momentum. It shows he's still basically stuck in the same constituency. Mm. I don't expect that to happen. But if it does, and the vote looks like it's relatively fairly counted, we'll have to start revising some of our understandings of what's going on. But of course, at the moment, we can afford to be arrogant and assume that we're right. I mean, in that case, though, I mean, let's say sort of Navalny's got 24%, but Savyanin's got 51%. Still, I mean, what Navalny will do is hold that meeting. He will still say that basically, you know, things were rigged against us. He has to, and in a way, he's right in the sense of even if there's not
formal rigging, there's going to be rigging.
Yeah, you know, I mean. The incumbent always has administrative resources in any election.
Right.
But of course, you know, those kind of virtues are on steroids within Russia.
Right.
And I think that falls within the category of what you can fairly describe as corruption. But anyway, the whole point is that's Navalny's shtick. You know, he has to play to it. But the point of the key thing is exactly what does he do with that 25%? Does he just simply say thanks very much? Or does he actually try to use that to build his support in two key places? One is his, you know, those people who voted for him, even though they are not his standard constituency, particularly, I would say, communists. And secondly, how he responds to the elite. I mean, again, you know, if he
and
turns
which
around,
elite he responds to.
Yeah, I mean, if he turns around and characterizes Sobyanin as just simply, you know, the devil incarnate or whatever, then he's closing a door, and I think that's actually going to be problematic for him. It'll be interesting to see if he himself tries to hint at or even talk about splits and divisions within the elite and variations. Because if he does that, then he's more or less implying, I am open for business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want to get on the, you know, basically start surfing the tide of history, then, you know, get your board.
I am
and
the
come
future,
join me.
Buy my
yeah.
stock.
Precisely. So I think that's going to be the key thing. You know, we know 90% of what he'll say. It'll be great tub-thumping, perfect sound-bited stuff. It's that 10% that is subtextually coding, you know, appeals to communists and appeals to members of the liberal elite that will be really important.
So it doesn't sound like you expect fireworks. You expect some posturing before some negotiating.
I'd expect, I mean, let me put it say, if there's fireworks, it's basically going to be because the Kremlin has messed up very badly.
Which
wouldn't be the first time. Exactly. I mean, this is what I mean. This is one of the fascinating things, the extent to which Navalny is not yet in a position to win. Actually, the Kremlin is placing itself in a position to lose.
Mm-hmm.
And it, on the whole, is managing to do that. With considerable facility. You know, that as I said, it's not going to happen instantly, but at the moment the Kremlin is losing, and the Kremlin is losing because of what the Kremlin's doing.
And on that note, we will shift to our second segment today. In a few moments, we will shift gears and recall a highly consequential autumn of two decades ago and discuss its relevance today. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the must-read blog In Moscow's Shadows. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at RFERL.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
День и ночь нас стало.
События в Москве были заранее планированы.
Российские правительные силы начинают штурмовать.
Президент обязал коменданта Москвы немедленно
обратился ко всем политическим.
Tear gas was used on them. It didn't stop.
We gotta get live on this.
It was only confusion.
When Yeltsin's opponents arrived at the TV center, they quickly forced their way.
At the time, it looked to many like a victory of Russia's fledgling democratic forces against reactionary elements who wanted to turn the clock back on reform. It was also the day post-Soviet Russia lost its innocence in many ways. But when President Boris Yeltsin ordered the shelling of Parliament in October 1993, literally pounding his political opponents into submission, it in many ways set the stage for the authoritarian super-presidency that dominates Russia today. Mark, we're coming up on the 20th anniversary of October 1993, and we're sure to have a whole podcast on that topic at the time. But as we enter this highly consequential autumn, one when change is very much in the air, I thought it made sense to take a look back. And I'll start with a provocative question. Was October 1993 post-Soviet Russia's original sin?
I think that's a really nice way of describing it, actually, because yes, I think one can point to a lot of the problems that have since emerged, and frankly, problems that or issues that are currently being played out with the rise of Navalny, to link it to the first part, back to that time. And there's three things, really. I mean, one is the creation of this hyper-presidential political system, which is personal, which really lacks effective checks and balances. That dates back to October 93. Secondly, the notion that in politics might can make right, the fact that actually the point at which Yeltsin turned against the Supreme Soviet, constitutionally he no longer became president. But that was all right because after he'd had his tank shell parliament into submission, he had a new constitution created that retrospectively made it okay. Again, I mean, I think that's actually a very pernicious way to start a constitutional regime. But the third thing is, I mean, you know, obviously at the time, you know, to understand it, I mean, there was this real fear still that the communists might come back. And I think the same impulses that meant that shelling parliament somehow became an acceptable political technique also led to this crash privatization campaign, this desperate scramble to get resources out of state control into anybody else's hands, which created the oligarchs, created this kind of criminalized, politicized economy that we have today with all of its various dysfunctions, you know, in the name of just simply the sense that any private hands were better than state hands. So all the, you know, these three, the presidentialism, the might-making right, and the oligarch economy, all in some ways really can be linked back to that tumultuous moment.
Now, I was in Russia at the time. Actually, when the shelling happened, I was actually physically in Ukraine. But I was in Russia through the summer and the fall that preceded that. And liberals cheered this on. Russian liberals cheered this on. And it became, to me, it also became a moment when Russian liberalism, and I didn't see it myself at the time, because actually, quite frankly, I found Rutskoy and Khasbulatov pretty frightening at the time. But it was at the time when Russian liberalism ceased to be liberal. Liberalism began to mean, it means keeping us liberals in power. Democracy means keeping us Democrats in power. You saw that go through the 96 election as well, which was, you know, had its problems, so to speak, where they hyped up the fear of Zhuganov and so on. So it was this moment when really Russian liberalism died in a lot of ways, no? And we're still feeling the repercussions of this again to this day.
Yeah, and then political liberalism was replaced by economic liberalism. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, there's no question but that Rutskoy and Khasbulatov represented a particularly noxious holdout from the old Soviet days. But in some ways, that is always the biggest test of democracy. Not actually, well, you know, when everyone agrees and everyone's nice, but whether or not actually one accepts that as long as they stay within the laws, people who have a democratic mandate, you have to accept that they have a position within the structure. So there was always this case of trying to save democracy from democracy. And it never truly survived. I mean, you say that sort of liberals cheered on the shelling of parliament, understandably, you know, again, in the time. But, you know, we shouldn't forget that a lot of liberals hailed Putin.
Yes, they did.
You know, that they thought that this was going to be the right man. I think that the problem is that Russian liberalism still hasn't moved on from a great man theory. Mm-hmm. That somehow the thing about liberalism is getting the right liberal czar. They're all still waiting for Alexander II to come back. And in some ways, we see that with the Navalny campaign.
Yes, we do.
you know, with this extraordinary cult of personality that there is around him. Now, certainly, you know, there is a massive difference between Alexander II, Yeltsin, and Navalny.
No, really?
Yeah, I know.
Go on, well, Mark.
I thought I'd better mention that just in case Kirill was worrying that I was moving into very dubious historical parallels. But nonetheless, you know, still this sense that actually that there needs to be some kind of a savior is, I would suggest, actually a very anti-liberal notion. But nonetheless, it's still very, very common and very present. And I think the combination of you know, the October coup, let's call it, and what happened in the 1996 elections, really ensured that at that formative moment, Russian democracy was never truly born, or else, you know, it was a particularly stunted beast. Now we might see it. Yeah. Now we might. Well, I mean, it wasn't still. I mean, it wasn't dead. Mm. I just think it was still dramatically limited. The interesting question will be quite what happens in the current sort of Navalnyite age of politics. You know, it is in his short-term personal interest to keep it personalized, keep it central about one figure. Will he actually, you know, because I think it's fair to say that, you know, he is, whether he becomes president ever, he is clearly going to be one of the key figures in the emergence of a new form of Russian politics. Will he be willing to, some, as it were, sacrifice the personality cult, sacrifice the personal benefit of a wholly sort of personalized form of politics, and precisely be willing to see it institutionalized, which will be true liberalism?
Right. Yeah, this is going to be the big test, and we don't know. He talks a great game right now about institutions. He really does. He gets my civic juices flowing when he talks this game. But everybody talks a great game about institutions when they're campaigning. You campaign in poetry, and you govern in prose, as Mario Cuomo once said. That's another way of saying you campaign with your ideals, and you govern cynically is another way to interpret that. And we just don't know, and we'll only get the chance to know is if Navalny ever gets the big chair.
Sure.
And if he does get the big chair and he does follow through on his rhetoric about institutions, then that will be a gigantic leap forward for Russia, a leap forward that Yeltsin was unable to make. And we've often drawn this parallel between Yeltsin and Navalny, down to the concerns about Yeltsin's communist past with his liberal rhetoric, then the concerns about Navalny's nationalism as combined with his liberal rhetoric. We just don't know. And I for one, simply as a Kremlin watcher, want to get the chance to see if this guy's for real or not. And the only chance we're going to get to see if he's for real is if he does get the big chair. Going back to 93. Could this have developed another way? I mean, I know this is another thing Kirill hates, is alternative histories, but the hell with it. He ain't here, so we're going to do it. And Kirill, I hope you're listening. But really, I mean, if you go back to that time, there was absolute gridlock. I mean, the forces dominating the parliament were quite retrograde. Could you have seen something good developing out of that if that were allowed to continue?
No. Something had to be done to break the gridlock. Of that, there's no question. And to be perfectly honest, I mean, however horrific the sight of the shelling of Parliament, and it's a sort of a fascinating irony that in the 1991 August coup,
right,
ultimately the hardliners were not able, both politically, but also I think it's fair to say in most cases morally, to actually deploy force against the protesters. In 1993, the Democrats had far fewer scruples. Even if Parliament was going to be shelled, it could have gone a different way. Yeltsin could have said, look, I have had to act outside the Constitution in order to resolve what was, frankly, an anachronism. Because, you know, the Supreme Soviet had been voted in Soviet times under a voting system that guaranteed that the communists were going to have a majority.
Right.
It did not reflect in any way a democratic plurality.
Now, Yeltsin was also elected in communist times, although in a direct election.
Exactly. I mean, if he turned around and said, look, I've had to do something horrific. You know, you have no idea how awful it was for me to have to deploy force in Moscow, but nonetheless, it was necessary. In doing so, I broke the Constitution. Therefore, we will have, whether it's a snap election or a plebiscite, and actually then had a genuine election. That, I think, would have washed away the blood of this particular original sin. The point is he didn't. And this has always been, for me, one of the depressing signs of Yeltsin, that he was politically a bully. When he was in a strong position, you know, whether it's humiliating Gorbachev after the August coup or consolidating power after the 1993 October events, you know, instead of, as it were, using that as a basis to win a democratic mandate, he just thought, oh, I have my enemies where I want them. I will now squeeze and crush them.
The man was not magnanimous.
I think that's fair. That's fair comment. So yeah, I mean, there are no inevitabilities. I mean, something had to be done to break that gridlock. But actually, it could have been a phenomenal and transfiguring moment if it had then been turned into an opportunity for true democracy. Mm-hmm.
It could have been a moment of renewal. Now, bringing it back up to the present, this anniversary is coming. It's a round anniversary. It's 20 years. It's hard to ignore. Mm-hmm. How do you expect this to be used now in Russia? I know I'll answer my question first, actually, because what I expect the authorities to do is to use this to play on people's fears of revolution and say we face a similar moment right now, perhaps. I expect them to use that, which would be ironic. Putin, who has staked his entire career running against the 90s, you know, if he were to use this moment to say this is what, you know, this is the kind of revolution we now face, to take the event and to use the event that basically kicked off those 90s that he has been railing against since he came to power. But that's one of the things I half expect the authorities to do. How do you expect this anniversary to be marked, used, spinned?
In terms of the public politics, I would agree. I mean, you know, it's all very well for political wonks like us to sort of get caught in parsing and noting the extent to which, as ever, the Kremlin's political technologists are ironically challenged. But I think, you know, for most people, it's precisely the scene of shooting in the streets of Moscow, of a political system that's moved into dysfunction because of kind of radicals, and, you know, communist radicals who can be presented as the bad guys. So I agree. Putin will try to use it as part of building to, which after all has always been one of his strengths, that sense of order is better than disorder. Mm-hmm. And if one has to accept certain compromises in the name of order, so be it. So that's, I think, the overt political level. I think, though, there's also, I think, a subtext that the anniversary is concentrating people's minds. I mean, going back to sort of, you know, an issue that is close to my heart, because it is a shriveled black heart, I'm particularly interested in things like the Praetorians, the forces that ultimately the Kremlin will rely on to maintain power, if it feels under genuine threat and is willing to use them. And it's quite interesting that I think we are beginning to see a certain renewal of those forces. Moscow traditionally has been cradled on a sort of a tripod of forces, each of which are meant to, if nothing else, check the other. The forces of the interior ministry, the forces of the army, and the forces of the security apparatus. And first of all, we're seeing changes and renewal in all of those three elements, particularly the Moscow-based ones, you know, ranging from the essentially honorific, the divisions of the Moscow garrison, which were meant to be converted into brigades along with the rest of the military, are now being told, no, you can be special divisions too. You know, which sounds petty, but if nothing else, it impacts the pay scales of the officers in charge, which matters. Isn't petty at all. Yeah, to actually, you know, forces being, you know, money being spent on the other forces. We also actually have continued rumours that in fact Putin wants to create some kind of new super presidential guard force. So, I mean, I think the interesting thing is that we're actually also seeing an extent to which Putin is clear that if anyone's seat of power is going to be shelled, he wants the tanks to be on his side, which, again, says something about the insecurities that are taking place. You know, we didn't see anything like this happening under the earlier Putin presidencies. Mm-hmm. He didn't feel at all assailed. He's now feeling worried. The point at which you start having to give your Praetorian Guard shiny trinkets tends to be the point at which actually an empire is beginning to teeter and totter.
Well, it certainly is going to be an interesting few months this season. And in a week's time, we'll have the benefit of knowing what happened on September 8th, which we don't have now. That, unfortunately, is all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me via Skype has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the must-read blog In Moscow's Shadows. Thanks, as always, for the great discussion, Mark.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant and unbelievably patient producer, Tanya Konchova, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and most definitely should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.